Conference number 5, 7:30 p.m., September 23rd, 1985. Father Hugo.
Prayer. We'll use this a little bit, a responsory prayer like we use at Mass. The response is, teach me your ways, O Lord. Your ways, O Lord, make known to me. Teach me your path. Guide me in your truth and teach me, for you are God my Savior.
Teach me your ways, O Lord.
Remember that your compassion, O Lord, and your kindness are from of old. In your kindness remember me because of your goodness, O Lord. Good and upright is the Lord, thus he shows sinners the way. He guides the humble to justice, he teaches the humble his way. Teach me your ways, O Lord. Now, before I forget, a couple of things I want to do. There's a pendant for this afternoon's conference. We didn't quite finish it, but one of the Beatitudes we were not able to include in the time that we had, and it's a very important one, and I don't want to omit it, so I'm going to come back to it. But first of all, I said we would have a little talk on prayer, a mini-conference on prayer. So get ready for a long one tonight. We'll have a mini-conference on prayer, and then we'll go into our regular conference. The conference on prayer is supposed to sustain you and support you in this week-long effort of prayer, and perhaps for the rest of your lives, to encourage you to grow in prayer, because prayer also is a growth, and we can and should grow in prayer. Well, now, as a reflection this evening on introducing us to prayer, I'm going to take you to St. Luke again, another lovely story in St. Luke, in the story of Martha and Mary. It's an ancient story taken as a basis for prayer. Yes, it's in chapter 10 of St. Luke's Gospel. Martha and Mary. On their journey, in St. Luke especially, but in all the evangelists, they're always on a journey. They're on their way to Jerusalem and to the climax of Christ's life. In St. Luke's Gospel, that journey starts in chapter 9, very early. And so most of it's on a journey. And now here's this chapter 10. So on their journey, Jesus entered a village where a woman named Martha welcomed him to her home. She had a sister named Mary, who seated herself at the Lord's feet and listened to his words. Martha, who was busy with the details of hospitality, came to him and protested, "Lord, are you not concerned that my sister has left me to do all the household tasks alone? Tell her to help me." And the Lord, in reply, said to her, "Martha, Martha, you are anxious and upset about many things. One thing only is necessary. Mary has chosen the better portion, and she shall not be deprived of it." That's the story. That's been taken from ancient times as a commentary on the Christian way of life. Martha stands for the active way of life, and Mary stands for the prayerful way of life, the contemplative life and the active life in tradition. Martha, we have a fellow feeling for Martha. We moderns, with our activity and our fuss, We can sympathize with her. We might think she got a bad deal here, but we're here to learn from the Savior, not to tell him what he should have said. This is what he said. No doubt Martha learned from this passage herself, and we honor her as a saint in the church. But she made a mistake. It was an understandable mistake, because among the Jews, hospitality was a very important virtue. Abraham had entertained God once under the form of strangers. He entertained strangers, and he discovered it was the divine presence. And so the Jews never forgot that, and they gave hospitality a very high ranking in their list of virtues. And Martha was dutifully carrying this out, but she was doing something else. She was neglecting her guest, the teacher, the one who brought us the divine wisdom. She evidently forgot that temporarily, and Jesus chided her about it. That was her temperament. She appears once again in the Gospels, and we have the same thing again. She didn't learn altogether. You know, she jumps up again. She's out at the very end of his life and runs forward. Mary stays. And so, but here it is. And so our forefathers, theologians, and teachers, now have taken Martha and Mary as standing for two types of life, two ways of living the Christian life, the active and the contemplative, the active and the prayerful. And they were concerned about which way is the superior way, which is the better way of life, and they alighted for their answer on the contemplative. The contemplative way of life is better than the active life, because Jesus praised it to Mary. And Martha then heard the active life is secondary. That idea took very great hold in the church. And this was why for centuries, I'm sure this was the reason that the only religious communities, like the Benedictines, were for centuries the only religious community. They were contemplative rather than active. And only in modern times did what we call active religious communities come into existence. The first one was the Jesuits for men, and the first one for women was the Sisters of Charity of St. Vincent de Paul and St. Louise de Marillac. But meanwhile, all the orders had practiced contemplation. They took a high priority. And, of course, the fact that Jesus said it was important. But St. Thomas took up the subject later, and he compared them, and he also agreed that considered of themselves an active life and a contemplative life, the contemplative life is more perfect. He said that. But, you see, they had a wrong idea of the active life, too, in those times. We know today from our experience that the active life is sterile. Everyone here probably has in their family a workaholic, or among their friends, people that we call workaholics. They work under compulsion. They take no joy in their work. They get no satisfaction from their work. They get no enrichment from their work. They are drained by their work, and they just can't stop working. We have them in the priesthood. We have them in religious life. You have them in your homes. Workaholics. The talk is full of them. I see them in Ann Landers and Dear Abby, you know. A common complaint of wives is, my husband takes care of us beautifully. We have everything we need, a beautiful home. We have cars. We have all we need to eat. But we don't have a husband. We don't have a father. He's always on the go. He's always moving. He's always active. Now, it's most of those letters are from women in there, but women can be alcoholics and workaholics, too, and are. So it's not a sex-linked fault. It's a human fault, and it can be either sex, these workaholics. And they are unhappy people, although they're all busy. And they keep talking about it, how busy, 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 busy we are, you see. But they don't get no joy. You know, a person's first joy comes from their work. Did you ever think of that? we think of work as a burden, the punishment of Adam. It's not a punishment at all. It's an extension of God's creative activity. And whenever a man or a woman retires, you see that. They wilt. They die. They lose that which they know best and love most, if they're fortunate enough to have a true vocation. There are many works today that are not true vocations. They're just mechanical works. They're just a job. There's a difference between a job and work as a vocation. And so people are bored by jobs and hate them. But a person is never bored by a work that they've chosen and which they love. You see. Well, so the point here is that work is sterile of itself. It's spiritually draining. It does not make for unhappiness. Where prayer fills one up, prayer fills one up. There's still the story of St. Margaret Mary, whenever she was a nun and when she was in the convent, that whenever she would go to the chapel in the evening with the sisters, she would kneel down and she would be wrapped in prayer. The sisters would get up and finish their prayers and leave, and Margaret Mary was still there, wrapped in prayer. They would go to their rooms and go to bed and sleep all night and come back to the chapel in the morning, and Margaret Mary was still there, wrapped in prayer. You see, prayer was not labor for her. It was sheer joy. And she had attuned herself so to God. Now, I'm not suggesting that everybody can do that, that she was a saint, a special grace, undoubtedly. But I'm just showing you these to show us what can be. And the prayer is something that fills us if we really pray. It, something that we can enjoy. Now, it's important to note, too, what was Mary doing that she received these words of praise from Jesus? How was she praying? Mary was listening to the Word of God through Jesus Christ. She was not busy about, and she was not even busy with her prayers. She wasn't reading them out of a book. She wasn't reciting them. She was listening to the words of Jesus Christ. My words, said Jesus on one occasion, are spirit and life. And that was what she was listening to. Words that are spirit and life. This is what prayer is. And this is why it's filling and fulfilling and satisfying if we really learn the secret of prayer. Many of our contemporaries are rediscovering that, even in our very busy, busy society, under the impulse of Oriental masters of prayer who come here. And we read of executives and athletes who are spending hours in meditation each day in prayer. And doing it to energize themselves with spiritual energy. Now, St. Thomas showed us gave us a further note about this. I'm talking here about St. Thomas Aquinas. Later on, he discussed this problem. He agreed that discontented with life was the better, but he ended up by saying the best life of all is the mixed life of prayer and activity. And he had only one reason for saying that. That was the kind of life that Jesus lived. You might say, that's the kind of life I'm living already. But don't be so fast. Don't be so quick. As St. Thomas understood it, and it's understood in Catholic theology, a mixed life is one in which the prayer is not incidental to the activity, squeezed in here and there as best you may, but in which the activity proceeds from prayer. Prayer flows into activity, you see. This kind of activity never drains you. Ask Mother Teresa about that. It makes you more energetic. It doesn't drain your spiritual energies, you see. It gives you more energy. It multiplies itself. It's very sad to hear today and to read in the magazines and papers complaints about from priests and religious and lay people. I'm thinking especially of lay apostles working in the apostolic life of being burned out. That's become a common phrase, burned out. I sat on the other side of a table not long ago. The young priest was on the other side, very handsome. He had everything going for him. He's the head of the youth movement in the great archdiocese, and that's the conversation he was telling me about how burned out he is. That's a sad confession. He should be increasing in energy if he were playing the game right. If he were living a life of prayer, it does not decrease. And St. Thomas puts it this way, our activity should then proceed from us not by way of subtraction, but by way of addition. We reinforce, we increase our inner resources by means of prayer instead of exhausting them. That's what the mixed life is. And, of course, St. Bernard will explain it this way. You must be a cistern before you can become a channel. A good illustration of that is Gandhi. We're not reading his life, but he was a wonderful illustration. He worked 15 hours a day. He got a couple hours sleep at night. He had the most difficult work of all, with people, all kinds. And I think one of the most remarkable little anecdotes in his life was he was asked one day, well, Mr. Gandhi or Mahatma Gandhi, why don't you think you ought to take a vacation? And his reply was the evidence of a truly prayerful and contemplative life, really in the Thomistic tradition. He says, I don't need a vacation. I'm always on vacation. You see, that's a supreme accomplishment. When your work does not drain you, when it does not exhaust you, when it inspires you and fills you with more. This is what St. Thomas meant by the mixed life. I think that's the kind of a life that a Mother Teresa lives. I think that was the kind of a life that Dorothy Day lived and a Peter Maurin. Ceaseless activity, but endless prayer. And the prayer becomes a source. We ought never to be burnt out. We should grow and grow and grow and grow till we die. And that would be the destiny of a Christian. And so this is the kind of a life I recommend to you, a mixed life in which prayer is the source, not an addendum, not something incidental, but right at the center, right at the heart, a source. And by prayer, I'm meaning the kind of prayer that Mary indulged in. The kind that Jesus said is the one thing necessary, the love of God, the prayer, interior prayer. I'm not talking about liturgical prayer here. I have great respect for liturgical prayer. That's our prayer together as a community. But this is inner prayer, the inward intercourse with God. So the inner life. Or mental prayer. This is what is meant here. Meditation or contemplation. In Catholic theology, contemplation is the highest, this infused contemplation is the highest kind of prayer. And this is the kind of prayer. So, if you're going to live this kind of a life, you see, we're not talking about it much during the day, but this must be the center of it all, a life of prayer. There is only one way that leads to God, said St. Teresa of Avila. She was one of the great teachers of the church. There's only one way that leads to God, and that is prayer. If anyone shows you another way, he is deceiving you. Remember that. There's no use trying to excuse substitutes. This is the only way you can truly energize your lives. You must take the time. And these people that today by tens of thousands are practicing transcendental meditation are giving us the lie when we say it's impossible. They're doing it. It doesn't take that much time. We're told it takes 40 minutes a day of your life, or 60 minutes, a holy hour. It doesn't have to be all at once. 2 20-minute periods, or three. It can't be fragmented any less than that, though, any more than that, to be effective. And you must find time to do it. And don't tell me, as one priest said, another priest was talking to him, he was telling me he didn't have time to pray. He spent 40 minutes telling me that. You know, justifying himself. And so that's what we can do. We can spend a lot of time explaining why we can't pray. Put it into prayer. So we have to organize our day. The first great thing we have to do is learn a wrist motion. Turn off the switch. So that's my recommendation tonight. One thing is necessary. Mary has chosen the good part, and it shall not be taken from her. Martha, learn from Mary. Now we'll pause, not for station identification, but to rest a moment, and we'll resume in 5 minutes. Pick up the thread. If you wish to stretch, third inning stretch, if you wish. Well, now let's proceed. As I said, I wish to conclude our conference this afternoon, which was on the Beatitudes, the two ways. We finished up our consideration of the two ways, but I omitted one Beatitude, and it's a very important one. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. I omitted it because I was working on St. Luke's version, and this one is in St. Matthew's version. You may find it in your new translation, Blessed are the lowly. The word meek has gotten a bad press among us, and I suppose they felt that it had to be changed. I remember one time when I was teaching in college that the Seton Hill, that we were talking about this, and I asked the class that, to what meekness is. What does meekness mean? And one young woman in the class said, meekness is a kind of weakness. And I think that that would express a very general impression among Catholics, that meekness is a kind of weakness. We hear those words, learn of me because I am meek and humble of heart. They're usually under a picture of Jesus, which looks at him very listless and weak. Most of our pictures of Jesus Christ are an insult to him and an affront to our religion, because they portray him as being utterly sentimental and weak. Even in the movies, the representation of Gandhi in the movie was much superior to the representation of Christ in the average life of Jesus. They put a Hollywood type of presumed gentleness in the role of Jesus instead of one who has strength and character and firmness. And so we interpret meekness along those lines. Meek, be learned of me, for I am meek and gentle of heart. If you wish to see an example of meekness, well, we saw one this afternoon in our reading of Gregory Bonhoeffer at the end of his life, standing before those tribunals in prison, cheerful, pleasant, loving, fully constrained, fully in command of himself. That is what is meant by Christian meekness. It is not weakness, it is the supreme moment of strength in any Christian who has that virtue. If you want to see where it's illustrated in the life of Jesus Christ, it's not illustrated whenever he has his arms around the children, although that was beautiful and he was meek. It was illustrated when he stood before Herod and before Annas and Caiaphas and was unafraid but respectful, was silent before Pilate. Meekness is a virtue. The simplest way to express it is a virtue which is the antidote for anger. It doesn't suppress anger, it transforms anger. It takes all the energies of one's being, all the energies of one's soul and body, of one's person, and transforms them into love. That is meekness in the biblical sense. That is meekness in the way that Christian writers have defined it in the past. This change, this concession on the part of the translators is regrettable, and from that point of view, although the word lowly does point the fact that the meek are the ones who suffer. The meek are the ones who suffer privation. The meek are the ones who are ground down, just like Jesus was. They're the lowly ones. But it's not just suffering. Meekness doesn't mean just suffering. It's suffering with equanimity, with patience, with love. With love for the persecutor. We can't understand meekness unless we connect it with that other passage in Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount in chapter 6. Of all that was said to you, love your friends and hate your enemies. But I say to you, love your enemies. Do good to them that hate you. Pray for them that persecute you. And now watch, he gives the reason for that. That you may be like your Father in heaven, who makes his sun rise upon the good and the bad, and sends his rain upon the just and the unjust. That you may be like God. This is being truly godly and superhuman and supernatural. That you may be like God. This was what Bonhoeffer did. This is what Gandhi did. He actually converted. Perhaps one of the most remarkable conversions in history was the way in which he converted his enemy, General Jan Smuts, who headed the British forces and the British government in Africa. And he changed him into his friend and admirer. He loved his enemies, and he did everything he could to help them. His purpose was always not to win over his enemies, but to convert them with love. To go as far as he could with them, to realize that they had a point of view too, and to accept that point of view, and to be familiar with that point of view, and to go with them as far as he could. This was Gandhi's meekness. Gandhi spoke ill of meekness, that virtue, because he didn't understand what the scriptures meant. Because we don't understand, but this is the way St. Thomas explains it, as the antidote of anger. And this is what Jesus teaches us. Blessed are the meek. We must not only temper our desires, blessed are the hungry, but when we are thwarted, we must temper our anger. Some of our desires meet opposition. And this is part of our control, to be able to overcome that anger. I don't even like that, overcome it, transform it. We have that sense today that this is psychic energy, and this psychic energy should be transformed from hatred into love. And then it helps us. So meekness is a virtue whereby we suffer deprivation, even up to the deprivation of life, like a Dietrich Bonhoeffer or like a Jesus Christ, without anger, without hatred, with perfect equanimity. Once an attempt was made to assassinate Gandhi, and once it succeeded. Both times he fell to the ground, repeating his mantra, his prayer word. He was not carried away by anger or for the desire of revenge. Rama, Rama, I love you, I forgive you. This is what meekness is. I think it is the ultimate virtue of the Christian. And whenever Pilate insulted Jesus and said to him, "Are you a king?" disdainfully and contemptuously, Jesus answered and said to him, "You said that." And he used against Pilate the only weapon that he would use, the weapon of the Spirit truth. He said, "For this I was born, for this I came into the world, to bear witness to the truth." That was his last word before he died, last word of instruction. Otherwise, he was silent before them. He was meek. So, we have to put this beatitude with the others. We have two sets of appetites, two sets of desires. One are called the pleasurable desires, the things we like eating ice cream, any joy, any enjoyment, sex. These we have to learn to control. The other kind of desires are the irascible desires, as the scholastics call them. The desire for something that's hard to get. Wading through the brambles to get a rose. Seeking some good in spite of enemies. You see, there are two different kinds of opposition. Opposition from the nature of things and opposition from our fellows. And here's where meekness comes in. To accept those pains for the good that we want, to be ready to suffer for it with patience and with love for those who are in our way. This is the ultimate secret and the ultimate arch of Christian love. We can't really say we love God with our whole heart unless we carry this out. Love your enemies as yourself. Why? That you may be children of the Father, that you may be like God. That's the practice of charity we've never insisted on, we've never even talked about. A contemporary scriptural scholar, Donald Sr., was requested within the last couple of years to give a talk to the bishops in the Pax Christi on enemy love, the love of enemies. And like the scholar he is, he sat down to find out what had been said by other scholars before. His talk is on tape, that was where I heard it. And he had to confess, after this research, he found only one book that even took up that subject in 2,000 years of Christian theology. That's how much attention we have given to it. And yet he comes out with the conclusion that this is what Jesus meant when he said, "I have not come to abolish the law, I have come to fulfill the law." This is the fulfillment of the law. This is the only thing that Jesus really added to the law of the love. The law of love was already in the Old Testament. Love your neighbor, love your Lord your God with your whole heart and your whole soul and your whole mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. But they misinterpreted that. They meant that love your friends as yourself. That's what they meant by the neighbor. And hate. Then they were free to hate their enemies, as we see in the modern Jewish state today. Retaliation is their law. And this was the only thing that Jesus said to you. But I say to you, love your enemies. This completes the circle. This completes the arch of loving God. So now that will complete our consideration of the Beatitudes for the time being. We'll come back to them later, maybe. Now let's go on to our next theme. I guess I won't finish it this evening. We'll finish it tomorrow. It's number two, Jesus the Way. We don't really part from our primary theme, which is the two levels. We're going to be talking about them for some time, but we're going to develop them further. And this second theme here, this second conference, is called Jesus the Way, a Doctrinal Roadbed. Whenever you build a road, we want a strong bed under it. We see the builders do that whenever they put highways in. They dig a roadbed. And we know what happens when there's not a... In the winter, with the potholes, we know what happens whenever the road doesn't have a very good roadbed in it. Around here in Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh especially, we have lots of experience of that. So we need a strong roadbed. Because what we're asked to do is gamble our whole lives on the things that we've been listening to and talking about today. On the fact that there is such a thing as a supernatural life, a destiny beyond our nature, and it requires us to go so far as to relinquish the goods of the natural world, or the desire for these goods. Just as what Jesus has asked of us. It's going to take a lot of faith to do that, and also a lot of conviction. And therefore we need to have this conviction. And, you know, too, we should point out to you that faith is a conviction. We sometimes think of faith as just a sentiment. But faith is truth. When we believe something, we believe it as the truth, as the wisdom of God, and therefore as the truth of God. And therefore we can base it's not just a sentiment, just a feeling. It's translated sometimes as trust. But it's not just trust, although it includes that. It's trust in God. Trust in God's Word. It's something deeper than just a sentiment. So in our letter to the Hebrews, there is a definition of faith which is not very familiar, and it's worthwhile looking at this point. It's in Chapter 11 of the letter to the Hebrews. We'll come back to that letter. We don't use it very often, but it's a very important part of the New Testament. And in chapter 11, verse 1, it says, "Faith is confident assurance concerning what we hope for, and conviction about things we do not see." Confident assurance of the things that we hope for. That's what faith is. And assurance, conviction about things we do not see. Conviction. Whenever we want to speak of a person who is strong, we say they have deep convictions. They have strong convictions. They are immovable. Of course, their enemies might just say they're stubborn, but we say, if we agree with those convictions, we say they are immovable. They have strong convictions. Dietrich Bonhoeffer had strong convictions about his duty as a Christian. He sacrificed his life for them. To do that, you have to have strong convictions. Well, we have to have strong convictions to live a life of faith. One of the great 19th century Protestant theologians, Kierkegaard, described faith as a leap. The leap of faith. It's like a leap into the dark. It's like a leap that a child would make, called by its parents, say in a fire. And the child leaps confidently that the parent will receive and break the fall. That's what faith is. It's a leap in the dark. Because, you see, faith is beyond reason. Reason wants to understand everything, but faith demands that we do things that we don't understand. We understand them not at all, perhaps, or even imperfectly. So faith is a leap in the dark. And this is why St. John of the Cross will describe the whole spiritual life, especially, as a dark night. Faith is a kind of light, but it's a very dim light for our human intelligence. And our human intelligence wants to understand things perfectly. Whenever somebody tells you, do this, you say, what's your answer? Even a superior, a boss, somebody above you says that. Why should I do that, you say? You want to know why. You want to know the explanation. And maybe you don't like the answer. You'll say, that's crazy. I won't do that. Now, God asks us to do many things that we don't understand, and that's what faith asks us to do. The great paradigm of faith is Abraham, who left his home and country on the promise that he was going to have a great family. And here he was, a childless old man with a wife of the same age as himself. And he made the act of faith, and it happened. So faith asks us to do things which seem crazy. We learn in school that faith doesn't contradict reason, but sometimes it seems to contradict reason. It's above reason, and it does contradict our practical judgment very often. So this is what we're asked to do, to live a supernatural life, to gamble our whole lives on faith. We don't want to do that, because that means that we can't eat, drink, and make good cheer anymore. That we have to change our course, that we have to change those convictions. We have to change our ways and change our ideas. It's easier to go on this way. Before I'm going to give up all those nice little attachments that I treasure and cherish, I want to really know why I should do it. And so we have to, that's why we stop here to speak of the roadbed, the convictions upon which our faith should rest. And so I'm going to offer you, not all, we take, in your case, we believe that I'm dealing here with people who are, if not all educated Catholics, you're intelligent Catholics, and you are somewhat educated, more or less. Each one of you have a different level of education in your faith. But all of you are articulate in your faith and are knowledgeable in your faith. We assume that. And so we can't go back and make a review of the whole of your faith, but we wish to review a couple of doctrines, and especially the doctrine which teaches us about the supernatural life and the fact that we share in this supernatural life. So I want to give you a couple of texts for that. The first text will be one that's familiar, like all of these, but also unfamiliar. And that will be, you'll find in St. John, chapter 3. It's a story, a lovely little story about Jesus meeting one of the senior Pharisees and teachers of the Jewish people, Nicodemus. You've heard the story before, and it's received a lot of attention in our time. Now, a certain Pharisee named Nicodemus, a member of the Jewish Sanhedrin, that was the highest governing body of the Jews under the Romans at the time. The Romans had conquered the Jews, and they were in charge, but they allowed the Jews, the Romans were very artful people, and they allowed the Jews a certain relative independence under their rule to keep them happy, and the Sanhedrin was the council of the Jewish elders who governed the people, made up of the Pharisees and the priests and the high priests there, because the Jews, there was no division of church and state there. It was all the same. And Nicodemus now belonged, an elderly man, apparently, from the story, a member of the Jewish Sanhedrin, came to him at night. See, the Pharisees didn't like him. So Nicodemus was friendly, but he was playing it safe. He didn't want to be seen with this guy. But what he'd heard about Jesus and seen about him disturbed him. He had God tugging at his heart. The hound of heaven was after him, too, and came to him at night, and he said, "Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one can perform signs and wonders such as you have done unless God is with him." Jesus gave him this answer. We don't know the question. Some of the versions of the Bible, maybe you have one of them, put the question in. It was a gloss, of course. Modern students of the Bible, what should I do to enter, what must I do to enter eternal life? We can imagine something like that Nicodemus asked.